Why do you hate families? Council?
Members of the committee, we're here to hear House Bill 3264, which directs state court administrator to implement a pilot program in one circuit court based on Hawaii's Opportunity Probation with Enforcement Program, otherwise known as the HOPE Program, for the purposes of evaluating the program's effectiveness in decreasing drug abuse, increasing compliance with terms of probation, and reducing recidivism. This would require the state court administrator to conduct a study of the pilot program using a rigorous evaluation and sunset in January 2012. It would also declare an emergency.
Thank you. Can I have Steve Dole and Howard Rodstein up first, please?
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, and invited guests. My organization, Crime Victims United, was founded in 1983 by members of Parents of Murdered Children to promote a more balanced criminal justice system through legislative action and public awareness. At that time, Oregon was nearing the peak of a 25-year rise in violent crime, during which our violent crime rate increased by 700%. Over the next 2.5 decades, we have advocated for tough sentencing laws for violent and chronic property criminals. We believe that these sentencing laws have been just and have been effective. Oregon prevents 100,000 crimes every year because of increased incarceration since 1995, according to the Criminal Justice Commission. Tough sentencing for violent criminals and chronic property criminals and effective treatment are complementary, not contradictory. We support treatment so long as it is rigorously evaluated and demonstrated to be effective. In 2007, 77% of felony criminals received non-prison sentences in Oregon. While Oregon's prison population is about 13,800, we have approximately 33,000 felony criminals on probation or post-prison supervision. It is evident that preventing these people from continuing criminal conduct is preferable to incarcerating them for further crimes. We believe that prevention requires a credible criminal justice system. Criminals and potential criminals must believe that criminal actions will have consequences. Treatment programs must contribute to this credibility. Today, we have assembled a panel to discuss a program that is credible and rigorously evaluated. We propose this program for your consideration as a model for Oregon. I'd like to thank a couple of people who have really been instrumental in helping us put this presentation on today, besides the chair and the members of the committee. Alan Fleischman of Representative Barker's office, Bill Taylor and Enola in the committee council, and along with Shannon Seville and Doug Wilson in the LFO. With that, I would like to introduce to you a board member of Crime Victims United, Howard Rodstein. Howard has been with Crime Victims United as long, or maybe a little bit longer than I have. He's, as I said, he's a board member. He's also our policy analyst. Howard is a graduate of Princeton University, and he owns a software business in Tigard, Oregon, that caters to the scientific communities. And with that, I'll turn it over to Howard to say a few words and introduce our panel today.
Thank you. And please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Howard Rodstein. I'm a Crime Victims United policy analyst and board member. Over the years, there have been many legislative hearings on treatment for drug and alcohol abuse and how it fits into the criminal justice system. In these hearings and in other forums, I've heard considerable enthusiasm for and confidence in treatment programs. After reading many papers describing programs in Oregon and elsewhere, it is my view that this level of confidence and enthusiasm is not justified by the evidence. The principal reason for my skepticism is the absence of rigor in our program evaluations. I believe we can, and in fact we must, do better. In 2006, a Washington Post op-ed entitled Reinventing Criminal Justice came to my attention. The author, UCLA research psychologist Dr. David Farabee, wrote about an intriguing concept, a different kind of program, which he described as an intervention of consequences and accountability rather than of social programs and therapy. I met Dr. Farabee in July 2007 at a meeting in Bend. I asked him for his thoughts on rigor in evaluating treatment programs for criminal offenders. He expressed the view that rigorous evaluation in the form of controlled studies using random assignment is essential for truly evaluating effectiveness. Dr. Farabee told me about a program that combined these two ideas, an intervention of consequences and accountability, and rigorous evaluation. This was Hawaii's program for felony probationers known as HOPE, Hawaii's Opportunity Probation with Enforcement. Today we have the opportunity to hear from two of the people responsible for the HOPE program, Judge Stephen Alm of Hawaii and Dr. Angela Hawken of Pepperdine University. And following them, we will hear from Dr. David Farabee of UCLA. Judge Stephen Alm has been a circuit court judge in Honolulu since 2001. Prior to that, he was a United States attorney for the District of Hawaii, and before that, he was a deputy prosecuting attorney in Hawaii. The secret to Judge Alm's illustrious career, however, can be found in his academic background. He holds a Bachelor of Science degree and a Master's degree from the University of Oregon. Judge Alm is the guiding force behind the HOPE program. Dr. Angela Hawken is a professor at the School of Public Policy at Pepperdine University, where she teaches graduate classes in research methods, statistics, and applied methods for crime and social policy analysis. She conducted the statewide cost-benefit analysis for Proposition 36 in California. That was a ballot measure in the year 2000 that mandated treatment for drug users. She is the principal investigator for the evaluation of the HOPE program. Dr. David Farabee is a research psychologist at UCLA and is director of the Integrated Substance Abuse Program's Juvenile Justice Research Group. Dr. Farabee is the principal or co-principal investigator for three NIH-funded addiction-related studies. He is also principal investigator for two California DOC programs. Dr. Farabee is co-editor of two books on drug treatment and is the author of Rethinking Rehabilitation, Why Can't We Reform Our Criminals? We need to get the most out of our treatment dollars. This requires identifying the most effective programs and terminating ineffective programs. The only way to ensure this is through rigorous evaluation using controlled studies and random assignment. I hope that the testimony that you are about to hear will convince you that the HOPE program should not be next in line for funding in the next biennium. It should be first in line. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, just please come on up.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Alm. I'm a judge from Honolulu, Hawaii. It is my distinct pleasure to be here to talk about HOPE probation. I do feel like I'm coming home in many ways, so thank you for your hospitality. When I was as a career prosecutor, when I got on the bench to the current assignment, I would get these motions to revoke probation from the probation officers. It would often be dozens of violations, often stretching back a couple of years, detailing all these problems with probation. Missed appointments, dirty urine tests, not going to treatment or refusing to go to treatment, and an almost universal recommendation that I sentence the person to 5 years, 10 years, or 20 years in prison. And I thought, this is crazy. This is not any way to change anybody's behavior. And this, I think our situation in Hawaii is probably similar to other places around the country. And to give you an idea of our scope, on Oahu, I'm a judge in Honolulu, a felony court level judge. Jury trials are what I do most of the time. We have over 8,000 offenders on felony probation or deferral, probation officers with these huge caseloads. Crystal methamphetamine has been our drug of choice for the last, well, not our drug of choice, sir. The drug of choice among many people in Hawaii for the last 20 years. Particularly, and I think cocaine is second, alcohol is always big. But many people have trouble complying with the rules of probation, and I think the probation officers saw that they had really two options. That was the dynamic, that they could try to work with the offender and talk to them about their problems and why are you testing dirty or why don't you show up for appointments, but they really didn't have any intermediate tool to use, and they'd have to try to threaten them or cajole them into complying with the threat that eventually, if this continues next year, you know, I'm going to tell Judge Om he should send you to prison for 5 years or 10 years. Well, for the folks we're working with, you know, next year might as well never happen. They could win the lottery by next year. They could get hit by a bus. It has no meaningful consequence. And so I thought, well, how could we change this system? How could we make it more effective? Because without anybody, you know, our probation officers are hardworking, they care about the offenders, but the way we're teaching them is the wrong way. It's like with your kid, your child at home, if they were doing something wrong, you wouldn't ignore it or only give them vague threats. And then if there were repeated warnings, repeated violations, next year kicking them out of the house. That isn't what you would do as a responsible parent. So I thought, well, how could we treat the probationers like we would our kids? How would we make them more responsible? And I looked at the statutes. I got together with some like-minded probation officers. And so during the summer of 2004, this kind of gelled. So I got on the calendar in June, and then we brought the prosecutors and the public defenders to the table and said, this is what we're going to try to set up a system to have swift and certain consequences. And you've got to start small when you want to change a system, because change is one of the hardest things to do in the world. But by starting small, we could try to get everybody working together and get over all the hurdles of what the problems are. And so it really, this is what was born, this collaborative strategy with all the moving parts. And we started with 34 offenders on October 1st of 2004. But in some of the meetings, I had asked the prosecutor, could you come up with a new form for the probation officers to use? A combined motion to modify probation, not revoke it, and an affidavit. So it's like 3 pages, fill in the blanks, takes 5 minutes for a probation officer to fill out. Because if it's going to take too much paperwork or to be too hard, nobody's going to want to do it. The public defender said to me, you know, Judge, the rules as on regular probation are the same, but you're really going to be enforcing them for the first time. So can you warn our guys of this? And I thought from a due process standpoint that made fair, and you know, from a fairness standpoint that made sense as well. I went to the jail and I told them, you know, you're probably not going to notice this at first, but you are going to notice it after a while that we're going to be sending more people for shorter, you know, short times. So your intake process you might want to take a look at. At first, you're not going to notice it because we're going to start with 34 guys. But I told them if we can keep one guy from getting a year in jail, we could have 52 people come for a week each. And so the whole idea is we're trying to reduce the number of people coming to jail or reduce the length of the time and certainly reduce the prison time. That was the goal, the number of people actually getting revoked and being sent to prison. So then with my U.S. attorney time, when I did that and we started certain programs, I went to see the U.S. Marshal, and he has a fugitive task force set up. They agreed to serve the warrants for my courtroom because law enforcement typically wants to chase after today's criminals, not go after folks that their warrants out on. And I'm sure our chair could, The people that are on probation are people we arrested a long time ago, and now the courts have them. But when I went to talk about the whole thing, they understood that the folks on probation are committing a lot of the crime out there. So if you can hold them more accountable, get them back into the system quicker, if they run away or don't show up, you can prevent crime from happening down the road. And so they agreed to give it a shot that way. Now, one of the key parts to it is we are trying to target the folks that are having the most problems on probation, knowing we're going to get the biggest bang for the buck that way. So the drug offenders with the worst drug problems were clearly the ones that were self-identified that way. And we looked at the folks that had been transferred from main branch probation to a higher risk probation group with slightly better caseload, 100 to 1 as opposed to 150 to 1 when we started. But they were ones who had refused to go to treatment, convicted of a variety of felonies, but had refused to go to treatment or had gone and failed, but were still testing dirty for drugs. The other group were sex offenders who are on probation. Not all of them had substance abuse problems. They have other issues, of course, but they have to go to treatment. They may have substance abuse issues, but the treatment when they're on probation is key, and we have to make sure they do that treatment. And so we tried to follow through with those target groups in doing that. And then we started on October 1st of 2004. We brought them in for a warning hearing. And we had 18 sex offenders lined up at 8:30 in the morning, and then we had the 16 drug offenders at 10:30. I told them, you're not 13 years old, you're an adult. You're going to make your own decisions, but everybody in this courtroom wants you to succeed on probation. But you're going to have to step up and start following the rules. So I can't control what you're going to do, but I can control what I'm going to do. And if you don't go see your probation officer, you're going to go to jail. If you test positive for drugs, you're going to go to jail. If you don't do those things and you comply with the rules, I'm not going to see you, and you're going to be able to carry on with your life. And we want you to be successful. We have treatment available if you want it. If you tell me you don't have a drug program now, but you come back testing dirty a number of times, then you will be going to treatment that way. So, and I asked, do you have any questions? Because if I see you again anytime soon, it means you're probably going to go to jail. But we did have, you know, what if I test dirty today? And I said, well, that's a pretty good question. But my guess is the probation officer, since the idea is we're warning you now for your future behavior, the probation officer probably will not test you for a couple of days. And the probation officers were in court. There were defense attorneys, prosecutors. Everybody was there to hear this. And we started on October 1st of 2004. And so the way it works now is if somebody has an issue, if they test positive, they are arrested at the courthouse. They have to call a drug test hotline every weekday morning. And if their number comes up, they have to come to the courthouse to get drug tested. And that's what happens every weekday morning. And we started with 34 people.
It's Friday, April 10th, 2009. Thank you for calling Hope Hotline. There is no testing scheduled for today. Have a great holiday.
Okay. Every day, they're told weekday mornings, holidays and weekends, they don't have to call. But we've got them into this routine. Every weekday morning, they're calling. And if they don't call, it's like Russian roulette. If their color comes up that day and they don't call, a warrant's going to go out the same day. Fugitive task force makes the arrest. After a year, we were having very good results. I went to see the chief of police and talk to him just like I'm talking to you now. And after a while, he said, so the idea is we've got these thousands of folks who are on probation. They're committing a lot of the crime. If we put more resources up front, then maybe down the road, we won't have to investigate the burglary or the car theft. I said, that's exactly what this is all about. It's trying to prevent crime in the future. And if you don't have to investigate the case, then the prosecutors don't get it, the public defenders don't get it, the courts don't get it, the probation or prison system doesn't get it the same way. Now, at that warning hearing, I actually hold up this wanted poster, and I tell them, if you abscond, if you run away, you don't go see your probation officer, you don't come for testing, the folks who serve all these warrants are going to come and arrest you. They're not going to come alone. People can get hurt. So even if you screw up, come in anyway, because I will take that into account in what I do. But if you're running away, we don't know what you're doing, so we're going to assume the worst. So, but if you come in, so if a person has a test, an appointment on Thursday, say, they miss it with their PO, but they come in on Friday and say, oh, I forgot. They're taken into custody. We have a hearing Monday. I often would give them credit for time served over the weekend. It all depends on the way they're doing it and how responsible they're being. And that's the way we try to do it. The police are doing the extra efforts for the warrant service. By doing motions to modify, it allows it to be much less paper intensive. Even the court staff, it takes 5 minutes. You don't have to do a new judgment. You don't have to list all the conditions of probation. You're just doing the two modifications. X number, 5 days in jail, seeing the probation officer. If new issues come up, we can add that in about mental health or if something else. But typically, we'll be able to follow through with it that way. And I want to emphasize, the short-term goal is to reduce the drug use, increase compliance with all of the conditions of probation, increase compliance with seeing your probation officer. If you're seeing your probation officer, you're going to treatment, you're more sober, you have a much better chance than for the long term to make the internal changes necessary to succeed in the long term. Because treatment works, but if folks know that there's going to be a consequence for dropping out of treatment right away or, you know, not completing their treatment, they're more likely to stick it out. They're more likely to want to, you know, give it a good try that way. And then if they drop out of treatment, they're going to get arrested. Some of the time, they'll just come down to the probation officer and turn themselves in. But they're going to get arrested, and then maybe we'll try a different treatment program. But there has to be a follow-up consequence to trying to doing this. And I think our biggest supporters are the Public Defender's Office, because they know their clients. They know leniency is not kindness, because if they keep having these problems, the next year they might get 5 or 10 years in prison. So some ongoing developments. We've discovered it works just as well no matter which judge does it. We have 6 felony judges in the program now, 3 domestic violence misdemeanor judges doing the program. Similar results with all of them. There's no operator effect. We started with 34 offenders on October 1st of 2004. They're now over 1,400, including over 1,250 felons. And virtually no hearings are contested. And that's the way this can work. I'm a normal felony trial court judge. That's what Mondays are sentencings typically, Tuesday through Friday, jury trials, and at 8:30 each day. During Tuesday through Friday, we have a few hope hearings. We have several on Monday. I'm averaging fewer than 20 a week. And I personally am supervising 580 defendants, 85 defendants on the program. Because you can do this in addition to everything else. I think I've had 2 contested hearings in the last 4.5 years. Partly, 2 reasons, I think. One is, you're talking about what happened either 2 or 3 days ago or last week often. So to the offender, to everybody else, you're talking about one thing. Did you use drugs a few days ago? Did you miss an appointment last week? Secondly, we're not sending them to prison for 5 years. They're going to get some time in jail, but it's going to be relatively short if they're turning themselves in, longer if we have to hunt them down. You know, it's proportional. I think the offenders themselves feel this is fair. Because it's one of the few things, I think, in the criminal justice system where they're actually told what to expect, and it actually happens. And it happens quickly. And it happens very quickly in most cases. We have most of the hearings within a few days, and I'll leave my colleague to follow through with that. We have a lot of, the typical sentence may be credit for time served the first time, maybe a few days in jail. It might be worth missing whatever they had planned this coming weekend. You know, people being what they are. Because when I talk to them at the warning hearing, I tell them, you may have your son's first Pop Warner football game coming up that weekend. If you pick up the ice pipe, you're choosing the ice pipe over your kid's football game. So you're going to miss that. But that's your choice. I can't control you. I can just tell you what I'm going to do. We have one of our, when we got the money from the legislature, we got $1.2 million. They were funding it for the last 3 years. $770,000 of that is for drug treatment slots. Because one of the things we've discovered is not everybody who smokes ice or snorts cocaine is an addict or needs to go to treatment. A number of people are able to stop on their own. It may depend on how profound their drug problems. They may be smoking ice every couple of weeks at parties. That if they, when they know they're going to go to jail, they can, some of them can stop. Others say they need to go to treatment. Or if they keep coming back and testing dirty, they're showing by their actions that they need to go to treatment. But that way, we can identify more readily who really needs the treatment. I think Dr. Farabee coined the term behavioral triage, identifying who's showing that they really need the treatment, which is why our treatment providers in Hawaii are very supportive of this, because then they're getting the folks who really need the treatment the most. There also were 4 probation officer positions in the money and 3 social service aides. So we have $25,000 a year court clerk, social service aid clerks doing all the drug testing so the probation officers don't have to do it. It has the added benefit of separating out the counselor probation officer from the testing. One of those folks comes in at 6:30 every morning to the courthouse. So if anyone has a paycheck job they have to be at, they're at the door. Security guard lets them in. They get tested. If they're clean, they go on about their business. They can make most paycheck jobs on a timely basis by doing that. If they have repeated violations after several of those, we may keep them in jail and have them go on an 8-hour pass to a program to get evaluated, back to the jail, come back to court, maybe let them go in after that. So we have been at this 4.5 years, almost 5 years now. It really has exceeded my wildest expectations. When we started with 34, I didn't think we'd be, 4.5 years later, over 1,400. The sky is really the limit as to how many folks can be put on this, because, again, I'm doing this in addition to the regular calendar. And it's really helping the offenders. And the offenders understand that. Their families understand that. Because if they can't see a probation officer, if they can't avoid drugs like this, they're going to have a hard time getting a job or keeping a job. And we're following through with that. So that's, we really have shown we can reduce drug use substantially with this. And even if guys have done time before, I think human nature being what it is, people can do time when they have to, but they don't want to do it today. And that's what drives a lot of the thinking. If I use today, I go to jail tomorrow. I don't want to go to jail tomorrow, so I'm not going to use today. Senator Clinton, Secretary of State Clinton, has said the United States has an insatiable demand for drugs. Well, I think we may have hit on something that can cut that demand. And my former life as a prosecutor, I couldn't think of anything better that would really hurt the drug cartels than if we could cut the demand in this country for drugs. That would hurt them, cut them where it hurts, and that's financially. So I'll be happy to answer all your questions. Later on, I'll turn this over to Dr. Hawken at this point.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Angela Hawken. I'm a professor of economics and policy analysis at Pepperdine University, and my accent is South African, not Australian. I became interested in hope probation when I was performing the statewide evaluation of Proposition 36. I conducted the cost-benefit analysis, and in looking at what started out as quite rosy data, and as offenders realized that they could mess up with no consequence, ultimately became not so rosy data, I was very interested in looking at for a program that might actually make a difference in these offenders' lives. A colleague of mine, Mark Kleiman from UCLA, contacted me and said, I've heard of a program in Hawaii and it really seems to work. And he started telling me some of the outcomes data, and I said, I don't believe you. I said, everybody's program works. They all look great on paper. He said, Angela, this one really does work. He didn't have to convince me too hard to take a trip to Hawaii to go check it out in person. And what is so unusual about the Hawaii experience is that, unlike many jurisdictions I visit, they were very, very transparent. They said, come in, look at us, warts and all, and see what's working and what isn't. That's a very unusual invitation to receive. We shouldn't be dismissive of nonviolent drug offenders. Nonviolent drug offenders typically do not receive jail time in most jurisdictions. Most of them will remain on probation under some kind of community supervision. Which really gives us an opportunity. If they're under our supervision, we have an opportunity to change their behavior, which often isn't taken. Our probation officers or parole officers are managing extremely high caseloads. There are limited treatment resources available and limited criminal justice resources available for managing that supervision. What's very important, though, is that a large number, and I'll cite some statistics from my own research today, is that a large number of nonviolent drug offenders will ultimately go on to become bigger fish in the pool. Not supervising them today has consequences for crime and public safety tomorrow. Just to give some background about why I was so enthusiastic about the HOPE program when I was first introduced to it, I'd like to, as I present this information to you, compare the two states, the experience in California with that of Hawaii. In 2001, California implemented what's called Proposition 36. It was a voter initiative passed in the year 2000. And what it allowed was for anybody convicted of a nonviolent drug charge, they had the opportunity of receiving treatment at a state-licensed drug treatment facility rather than jail or prison, or what was more typically the case, just probation without the requirement of treatment. Proposition 36, if an offender accepted the bargain, would be mandated to treatment. What Proposition 36 did not do was have any teeth written into the law that would require those offenders who accepted the bargain to actually attend or appear before at the treatment providers. To give you a sense of this, the pipeline that you're seeing on the screen in front of you is the pipeline of California's Proposition 36 offenders. Each year, about 60,000 offenders are convicted of nonviolent drug charges. And of those, about 48,000 are actually referred to Proposition 36. From the time of referral to assessment, about 15% of those drug offenders will abscond. From being assessed to actually arriving at a treatment facility, another 13% or so will abscond. The actual percentage of offenders who will go all the way through treatment and complete it is around 25%. When interviewing these offenders on why it is they didn't arrive or what happened to them if they didn't arrive, the modal response from the offenders was that nothing happened to them. Nothing happening to you is not a highly motivational way of managing offender behavior when you're trying to mandate them to treatment. In a program like Proposition 36, when you mandate a treatment requirement, as the judge mentioned, not everybody who uses drugs has a diagnosable drug disorder. When you mandate treatment for all, what you ultimately end up with is a little bit of nothing for everybody. And this is what we saw in California. We required that everybody go to treatment whether or not they really needed it. The result is that many people, we actually received many, many more addicted people than we ever expected. The level of addiction was higher. Following the implementation of our new law, the kind of treatment you would receive if you were a seriously addicted Californian fell, because there were many, many more people seeking treatment and limited resources to go around. So what you ultimately saw was large levels of outpatient care. This was often not very intensive outpatient supervision and very little treatment resources, intensive resources, such as inpatient care, residential care, for those seriously addicted users, of which we had many. We surveyed the treatment providers under Proposition 36 and asked them, why is it that your clients aren't coming? Is it because of the usual things we hear about? They don't have transport. They have issues with their family. They have to look after kids. They have housing problems. They have work scheduling problems. Overwhelmingly, the treatment providers told us that the reason their clients were not complying with their treatment plans is that they were simply unwilling to comply and that they lacked motivation. These results are from a randomly drawn sample of Proposition 36 treatment providers. There were 87 of them in the study. A serious problem for the California system now is that what was initially coined, it came into legislation as the Substance Abuse and Crime Prevention Act, has turned out to be, instead of SACPA, SACA, the Substance Abuse and Crime Creation Act. Because what has followed since the implementation of Proposition 36 is an increase in arrest rates. If we compare those who entered and never actually set a foot at a treatment provider, those who entered and got some treatment but didn't complete, and even those who went all the way through treatment, their arrest outcomes are worse than a comparison group of matched offenders. Statewide, we've seen a large increase in drug arrests since the implementation of Proposition 36. I will caution you whenever you consider looking at statewide drug arrests or any crime arrests at the state level. Many factors drive crime rates. I'm not implying that this is causal, but once you see Proposition 36 kicks in, there's a huge spike in particularly hard drug arrests in California. Marijuana went up, but the harder drugs certainly went up following Proposition 36. We've seen about a 56% increase in arrests for hard drugs since the law was implemented. We tend to label nonviolent drug offenders, we give them that label and I think many people immediately assume that this is a relatively homogenous group. Drug offenders are not drug offenders. The graphic in front of you, and it looks complicated, and I'll walk you through it, looks at the distribution of follow-up crime costs that these nonviolent drug offenders incurred in my follow-up period of my study. How you read the graphic is if everybody was essentially the same, if they all contributed the same amount to the crime costs in their follow-up period, they would all line up nicely on that 45-degree line, that solid line going up through the middle of the screen. The more unequal their contribution is to follow-up crime costs, the more that curved line moves away from that straight line. So essentially how you can read this, if you go to along the x-axis, the bottom axis, that horizontal axis, about 40% of these offenders contribute nothing to crime in follow-up period. These are the good guys, the little fish. If you go to the right-hand side of the curve, you see where all the bad news is. About 70% of the offenders contribute about 30% of the offenders contribute about 70% of the follow-up crime costs. So we have some bad fish here that are really driving the social costs of crime. This graphic that you're seeing now only considered costs to the state budget. It did not include victims' costs. It did not include the cost of your radio that was stolen. Only the costs the state itself incurred, costs of going out and policing them, hunting them down, bringing them before the courts, and actually and charging them. The graphic becomes even more skewed if you add in the costs to victims. So essentially, we can think of this as three groups of offenders. We have the green light guys, who are the kind of the goody two-shoes on the left, who aren't doing very much. We have the chappies in the middle, the guys and girls. We have about 30% of our offenders were female in the middle, who are starting to add to crime costs. And we have the really bad apples on the right-hand side, who contribute disproportionately to follow-up crime costs. When you have a law that doesn't allow you to differentiate these types of offenders, when their behavior doesn't trigger changes that make you manage them differently, you have a real problem. And it's exactly what we've experienced in California. There is no behavioral triage in California. I like to refer to the concern of the peril of the pendulum when it comes to California. I've watched lobbying groups and seen treatment groups and law enforcement groups often think that they have less in common with each other than they really do have. We often hear the language of the good guys are the treatment providers and the bad guys are the law enforcement providers. The truth is that the one cannot exist without the other. We tend to swing one way or the other, either going towards pro-treatment or pro-law enforcement. But if we're ever going to make a true difference in the lives of these offenders, we have to find something that settles somewhere in between. In surveying our treatment providers in California, we asked them the question, would jail sanctions improve compliance and treatment outcomes for your patients? We expected that the treatment providers would be anti-incarceration. I think that's the thought in the street, is that providers are anti-jail sanctions. Over 81% of our treatment providers said that they absolutely thought the most effective way to treat their clients was to permit minimal sanctions. And they, by minimal sanctions, we were specifically asking about jail sanctions. Treatment providers themselves were calling for jail sanctions. They recognized they cannot treat their patients if the patients aren't there. They certainly needed additional motivation to make them comply. So California hasn't been a glowing success. We did have what I call the honeymoon period. The law was implemented immediately following this diversion program. We saw large drop-offs in our prison population as these guys were diverted from prison and jail into treatment providers. The honeymoon period lasted about 2.5 years, and that was gone. They were back. Eventually, a small fish becomes a big fish if nothing happens to them. This behavioral triage model is why we really like the idea of the HOPE program. This is a program where treatment decisions are based on the probationer's observed behavior. If you respond to them because of something they have done, it is much more salient to them. So this is a feature of HOPE that we really, really liked. It also allows us to allocate our treatment resources more effectively. We have limited treatment resources. We have to be spending those resources on the individuals who really need the care. Spreading it around isn't helpful. Treating individuals without a diagnosable drug disorder isn't very useful. Not for themselves, and it's also not useful for the people in those treatment groups because they often tend to spoil the group. It was another comment we heard from our treatment providers. When I had individuals mandated to treatment who didn't really belong there, they ruined it for everybody. So these were the tenets. As researchers looking at how do we bring about behavior change, how do we bring about positive behavior change, this is what we'd really be looking for in a program. And these were the tenets of HOPE that we were trying to test when we went about the evaluation. Are the sanctions certain? The rules of the game have to be certain if you expect compliance from these offenders. Are they swift? If the sanction isn't delivered very quickly, it lacks salience. Are the judges or is the criminal justice system applying these sanctions consistently? Again, making sure the rules of the game are really clear. And what we were looking for was sanctions that were parsimonious. And by this, I mean, what is the least amount of sanction we can give? What is the minimal amount of jail time we can give to bring about the desired behavior change? We all know that there are negative consequences of incarceration. If we can find that optimal number, the number of days that makes them change their behavior, we have sanctions that are parsimonious. So we began our evaluation of HOPE. We began in what was called the Specialized Probation Unit. And this was a unit full of remarkable probation officers who were very well trained, and they were overseeing relatively small caseloads, about 100 to 1. When I started taking the study on the streets to describe outcomes across the country, a very common criticism I received was that, well, this just doesn't look like our jurisdictions. We are not managing caseloads of 100 to 1. We have general probation units, and the caseloads are very, very high. So very soon we realized that if we were going to have a result that could generalize to other probation officers, what we needed was a HOPE program in a general probation unit where caseloads looked similar to what they were elsewhere in the country. So we conducted what was a true randomized control trial in the general probation unit, where the caseloads are larger, 170 to about 180 to 1 in the general probation unit. What we found across courts, we did find that the sanctions are certain. The judges in Hawaii are delivering the sanction. If the probationers mess up, something happens, which is an absolute key ingredient to this model of swift and certain sanctions. We did find that the sanctions are swift. They've managed to adjust their system so that 70% of all of the hearings are held within 72 hours. This is extraordinary. If you look at how sanctions are usually delivered in response to a violation, in many jurisdictions it takes multiple weeks, and in most places it takes multiple months before any sanction, any consequence is applied for a violation. The sanctions are not consistent. They failed this one. We did find that, well, judges are judges, and I know we probably have judges in this room. And for many years of studying criminal justice data, I can tell you we absolutely know how to manage probationer behavior. Changing probationer behavior is easy. Changing judge behavior is hard. Judges love to have discretion. And what we have, and I have one particular judge in my data set, and for reasons to keep him anonymous, I refer to him as Judge Starr. He's my outlier judge. He's my draconian judge. He likes to put people away for a long time. He messes with my data, and he messes with my costs. He also doesn't have any different outcomes. All this judge does is he wastes the time of the offender, and he wastes taxpayer money. The probationers he's overseeing have no differences in outcomes. Whether you send them away for 2 days or whether you send them away for 40 days, they're going to have the same kind of response. This is a very important lesson for the criminal justice community if we're trying to constrain costs. What we are seeing, and Judge Starr is included in this, for the first violation in Hawaii, we're seeing about 6 days are given. Most of the judges are quite reasonable and are very responsive to offenders who have paid jobs. If you have a job, most of the judges will allow you to serve your term on a weekend. One of the most protective factors we find for probationers is employment. Separating them from the employment opportunities is a very bad idea, and the system tends to be working really well with the probationers in that regard. As the strikes increase, so does the sanction. For most individuals with a second violation, and again, this includes Judge Starr, we're seeing an average of about 14 days. By the time they get to a third violation, the sentences get much longer, and at this stage, the judges are starting to think of a relatively long time in residential care. The average jail time for a third strike is 48 days. If we take Judge Starr away, it drops to about 26 days. And as these strikes start to accumulate very soon, by the time you get to the third violations, we're talking about very few probationers. Most of them, once they realize the threat is credible, never reappear before court. They just stop. And they were selected into the study as high-risk, primarily methamphetamine-using probationers who had a long history of completely snubbing the criminal justice system. Lots of drug use, regularly missing appointments, regularly testing positive. That they never came back, even though they were regularly randomly drug tested, illustrates that many of these guys and girls can do this on their own as long as there's a credible threat. Very few of them will come back for a third violation, and we have a, what's called a long right tail. A few people who come back over and over again, I think up to 8 times we've seen people coming back, and those are offenders who, through their own behavior, have signaled they have a very serious drug problem. If even when facing the immediate threat of a jail sanction, you cannot do it on your own, we now recognize you have a serious problem. And because we haven't spread the resources around, we now have the drug treatment resources to provide them excellent levels of care. And that's exactly what's happening in Honolulu. If you're showing yourself as a repeat offender under HOPE, we often see 2 years of mandated residential treatment in extremely fine facilities. The kinds of outcomes we're seeing, and again, I have to tell you, when I first saw this data, I didn't believe it either, so bear with me. It's being collected by really good researchers. We have repeated data collection on my own. We've cut this a thousand different ways. Compared with baseline data, the missed PO group, the missed PO appointments, missed probation appointments in the HOPE group, these are the guys who were assigned to HOPE probation, they fall by 85%. The comparison group recognizes that they can get away with this. Their missed appointments actually increase as you track them over time. There's no sanction for bad behavior. The positive UAs in the HOPE group over baseline dropped 91%. There was no change in the comparison group. There was other key outcomes we've observed. There were significant differences in arrest rates for the comparison group versus the HOPE group. The comparison offenders were being arrested at a rate that was 3 times higher than the HOPE probationers. And very importantly, from the perspective of prison housing, the revocation rate was much, much higher in the comparison group versus the HOPE group, even though the HOPE guards were being so much more closely monitored. The revocation rate was over 3 times as high for the comparison group. Then we moved on to the randomized control trial. I'm not sure if everybody's familiar with the difference of a comparison group and a control group. A comparison group is when you have a study that wasn't conducted along the lines of a randomized control trial. What they do is they find a matched group of offenders that look like you, or look like your group. So you're looking at the difference between the treatment group, the group receiving HOPE, and a group of matched offenders. A randomized control trial is a true experiment. We started off with a group of high-risk offenders identified by probation officers according to a list of criteria, and I flew into Hawaii, and in front of the probation officers, I pushed a button, and randomly offenders were assigned to one of 2 conditions, either treatment as usual under probation or HOPE probation. The control group, and in this scenario, the outcome data in the general probation group wasn't quite as good as it was in the specialized probation group, and there's a couple of reasons for this. First of all, they had higher caseloads in general probation, and also the cats in general probation weren't quite as bad as those in the specialized probation unit. So the worst of the worst were allocated in specialized probation. And if you start off with really high behavior, you have more room for improvement. That said, the outcomes were still greater than anything we've seen in any other criminal justice program in the country. Big effect sizes, just nothing like we've seen, just not quite what we'd seen in the specialized group. The control group was testing dirty more than twice as often. Their arrest rate was 34% higher. And if you if we looked at non-technical violations, most of the HOPE guards were being violated on technical conditions because they were testing dirty. If you took away the non-technical violations, the arrest rates between the two groups were very different, and 111% higher in this is a new crime. 111% higher in the control group versus the HOPE group. Well, how do people feel about this program? We fundamentally changed the way they do business in Hawaii. What does it mean for people in the system? The green bar are people who said that their general perception of HOPE was positive. The yellow bar said it was satisfactory. The red bars are those who had a negative perception of the program. Notice the probation officers, and these are the guys who've really had to change how they work. They work much more quickly and much more efficiently. The POs love this program. About 90% of them had expressed positive sentiment, not a single PO in the system. And we had a census. We had a full census of POs. Every PO managing a HOPE caseload is included in the study. Not a single one of them had a negative comment about the program. Judges, too, were enthusiastic about the program. We had some negative responses. About 25% of the prosecutors had some concerns about the program, and their concerns were valid. The kinds of comments we heard from the prosecutors were, well, in Hawaii, we don't have an established list of criteria for determining who's eligible for the program. They were worried that some big fish may end up in a program like this that may well have been better suited to incarceration versus this kind of community supervision. The public defenders across the board tended to be relatively enthusiastic, with about 18% of them expressing negative sentiment. And the court administrators, this is really more court assistants, people who are assisting the judges, that labels a slightly unfortunate one. They were the most negative, and our understanding of that is because they were the most removed from the probationers themselves. They didn't really see, they just saw an increase in workload. They didn't see any of the good stuff happening. Their judges were busy. They were moving paper around. As this program rolls out in other jurisdictions, we'll certainly recommend looking at the workload issues. We did that for the probation officers. We mitigated their workload by rationalizing what they did. The same exercise wasn't conducted for court administrators, so rolling this program out in future, certainly looking at workload mitigation for court administrators would be helpful. And this is probably what was the most surprising of the study. These are the probationers themselves, and we surveyed 211 of the HOPE probationers. That's nearly half our sample is included here. And we separated them into four groups, those who are receiving treatment. And under HOPE, treatment can be really long. It could be 6 months in residential care. It could be two years in residential care. We surveyed those in jail, those who are being supervised by the specialized unit, and those in the general probation unit. As you can see, overwhelmingly, the bars are green. The probationers loved HOPE. We never expected to see positive response from those who were incarcerated. We interviewed every single incarcerated defender under HOPE in jail. While they were in jail, and some of them had just gotten there, they hadn't even sat down yet, and we were interviewing them. These should be the most angry men and women on earth, and they still didn't have negative comments about the program. And repeatedly, when asking them to motivate why they were reporting positively about the program, they just kept saying, because it's fair. I'm here because I messed up. It's not because of the judge. It's not because of the PO. I did it. This concept of fairness is a very key feature of this program. General observations of the HOPE based on the evaluation. We found that the effect of HOPE, the dramatic reductions in drug use, dramatic reductions in missed appointments, dramatic reductions in follow-up arrests, dramatic reductions in revocation, held across probation officers. It holds against probation officers. And it holds across judges, even the judges who don't like the program. None of the judges don't like it, but even those who are less enthusiastic about the program had equivalent outcomes data. Essentially, our study has suggested that effect sizes are larger for higher-risk probationers who are supervised in the special probation unit. My one concern with that, though, is it might lead us to think that a policy recommendation would be to only use this program on the big fish. Our study had a relatively short follow-up period. We're looking at 1 year of data. As I said before, we can see very clearly that little fish become big fish. My study in California, I actually just called a student this morning and made him run the numbers. Individuals who came into Proposition 36 on a nonviolent drug charge and had no priors, nothing else in their lives, within 1 year of follow-up, 10% of them had become a high-cost offender. To be a high-cost offender, you had to be committing some pretty serious crime in California. So little fish become big fish, and not dealing at all with the little fish could have consequences down the line. We found that even though the application by the judges was uneven, what that had was an implication for costs because they added to jail time, but it didn't have an implication for outcomes. The findings are robust across judges and across implementation technique. Are there limits of our study? Absolutely. The study term, we only had a one-year follow-up, absolutely limits the lessons from our randomized control trial. As this study group matures, we'll be able to tell more. We do have four-year follow-up data on the original group put in HOPE, and their outcomes get progressively better as we track them over the long haul. There were spillover effects from HOPE, and this is a fascinating finding. The probationers would go to a communal probation office to receive their appointments with their POs, and they'd be sitting in a waiting room. Now, probationers who were not assigned to HOPE, you can imagine the experience. You go to HOPE, to the probation office, you're not a HOPE client, you sit in the waiting room, and you see someone else who looks just like you going to see his PO. He tests dirty when he pees in a cup, and suddenly the sheriff takes him away. Watching that happen changes how you feel about whether or not you're going to use tomorrow. So what we did find is that as we watched this happening, the probationers who were sharing probation officers attended to rise all ships. The word got out that probation actually meant business, and they didn't realize that they were not in the HOPE program. This does have important implications for reputation. A HOPE-type program will never work if it loses reputation. The judge mentioned in his comments to you that this is the kind of program that has to be rolled out in small doses to begin with. Start with a small number of offenders and scale up. If you ever lose your credibility, if you ever lose reputation, this program, I guarantee you, will not work. If you do not have the mechanisms in place to follow through and enforce credible threats, no one will take you seriously, which is the experience in California. We have some questions about generalizability, and I expect that if I didn't say this now, many hands would go up as I finish speaking and say, Hawaii is not Oregon, it's not Washington, it's not California. And this is an island state, things work differently. Well, we have, because of the findings of the HOPE evaluation, there are now other jurisdictions that will be picking up the HOPE program, and it remains to be seen how well these lessons generalize to other jurisdictions. It's hard to imagine, though, this is a group of highly drug-involved methamphetamine users who fundamentally changed their behavior. It's hard to think of why the same lessons wouldn't apply in other jurisdictions. But there is an issue where I do have some concerns about generalizability, and that has to do with Hawaii had Judge Arm. He had a person who had a lot of credibility in the system who could make all the players collaborate to make this work well. I am concerned as we move this program to other communities that we might not always have the leadership in place to make a program like this work. Hawaii had Judge Arm. Other communities will have to identify their Judge Arm, their champion that will take a program like this and work with the moving parts. The other issue regarding generalizability is the POs in Hawaii are really quite good. They're well-trained. They appreciate the role of treatment. They all work very hard to improve the lives of the probationers that they serve. Making sure you have your criminal justice side have a true respect for what happens on the treatment side is an essential part of this program. I also have some concerns about the ability of other jurisdictions to credibly deliver the sanction. If it's not delivered swiftly and with certainty, a program like HOPE certainly will not work. Thank you for your attention.
Chair, just so I respond, could I add a couple of things here? Regarding Judge Starr, this was presented. I saw evidence of this a couple of months ago. So I sat down with the administrative judge and who I was guessing Judge Starr was. And I talked about the results being good, dropping down, and he's another career prosecutor like I was. So I said, there's one judge, I showed this same slide to him, and I said, I know it's not me, so my guess is it's you. And he explained, you know, what he was doing about different things and why he was treating them differently and were they taking responsibility. And we were all on the same page with it. I just said, could you give some thought to throttling everything back? Because I don't think the offenders think I'm an easy touch. I just start shorter and go up. But this is absolutely reality that different judges are, you know, you can imagine this has to be carefully done, cautiously done. We have to work together. There are, of course, no egos on the bench anywhere. Yeah. But it worked out. And if a judge is in the middle of a really busy murder trial or whatever, they can always push the hearings to the following sentencing day. The person stays in custody in the meantime. But that's one of the reasons why those numbers of within 72 hours would be even higher, except I know a couple of the judges push it back. It could be up to 6 days then. If it's a sentencing Monday and it happened Tuesday, it would get pushed to the following Monday. But those guys are staying in custody in the meantime. So you're having the hearing. They probably had more credit for time served in that situation. And we do have benchmarks, and in my handouts to you folks, that's one of the handouts to the courts. These are like 11 points we think are really important for folks to consider if they're looking at a HOPE-type project. So I just wanted to interject that following up on Judge Hawkins.
Thank you.
Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time today. I'm David Ferriby from UCLA. And I'm going to provide really not a discussion of a program, of any program in particular, but of hopefully a process by which good programs can be selected. Dr. Hawken mentioned the idea that the pendulum that's often invoked, the concept of the pendulum going from one extreme, the punishment and lock them up, so is the key, and the treat rehabilitation side of the other side of the pendulum. And we tend to go back and forth, and there's probably a good reason for that, and that is because we tend to grab to go from one overly simplified extreme to another. We are now moving, and I outlined this in my written testimony, that I won't necessarily go into it right now, but there are a number of reasons, and other historians have observed that since about the year 2000, we have seen the pendulum moving towards the treatment end. Now, that's a good thing. I don't think anybody is against making people better and reducing the risks that they pose to society. But it's only a good thing if, in fact, we are putting good programs into place. Now, I know among the many things that that have led to this kind of this decade of change in terms of moving towards rehabilitation, just incapacitation, we can add to these lists to that list Oregon Senate Bill 267 and the House Bill 3563, where there is a very noble attempt to improve offender rehabilitation and reduce recidivism by requiring state funds target programs that are considered evidence-based. So I wanted to kind of be an end note to our discussion this afternoon to make a few points about the importance of being very specific with your language when you have these requirements into place. I first would like to thank you, this group, for recognizing that intuitive appeal is not in and of itself a sufficient benchmark for determining whether a program works. And your awareness of this has made you a national leader in corrections policy. But I also hope to, since you were willing to make this big step in the first place, I hope to convince you to take one last step, because the difference between requiring pretty good studies and really good studies is enormous in terms of the implications of what actually gets vetted and put into place and then what the actual outcomes are. Let me just quickly, I know you all know this, but I want to just run through a couple of the major points in the Senate bill that describes what the criteria should be for a good evidence-based program. For it to be scientifically based, the legislation reads that it should employ systematic empirical methods based on observation or experiment. Or experiment, it doesn't require that it be an experiment. And by the way, experiment, we hear the term experiment used, experimental jazz or experimental whatever. Experiment in this case means random assignment, not just trying something, but a random assignment. That's a critical point. Two, that involves rigorous data analyses. And three, that it relies on measurement methods that provide reliable and valid data across evaluators and across multiple measures and across studies by the same or different investigators. These are critical features of any good study, but they also, unfortunately, allow many bad studies to still come through the filter. So there's a growing, fortunately, in the criminal justice literature, there's now a growing number of evaluations that have been published, and many of these studies range substantially in their methodological rigor. Now, this is critical because the quality of research designs have been shown to account for more variance in outcomes than the actual intervention being studied. In other words, defining what constitutes an evidence-based research study is more than just academic nitpicking, and I hope I can make that point successfully today, because it represents very practical determinations of what works and what doesn't work. And truly rigorous studies, experimental studies, tell a very different story than studies of low or even moderate quality. And with that, let me introduce my one slide. In 2001, some researchers took a 68 offender rehabilitation studies, and they said, let's rank them from 1 to 5 in terms of methodological quality. 1 being a single group. We get a group at baseline and we follow them up. We don't have a comparison group or anything. And 5 being random assignment, good Cadillac study. Fortunately, there were no ones in their literature review. But if you'll notice, that I have on the vertical axis as effect size, and I won't go into a lot of detail, but in general, you really want something, a 0.2 effect size is where you start getting meaningful from a policy standpoint, 0.2 or better. And so they said, well, let's see, how did these studies, the programs are evaluated using the pretty weak research methods, a 2 out of 5, how did they do? What kind of effect size on average did they have? And that was a 0.83. That's enormous. That is enormous. I don't know of any real world interventions, clinical, correctional, anything that provides that kind of consistently that kind of effect size. When you move the study quality up to those who get a 3 out of a 1 to 5, you get a little bit smaller, but still a pretty respectable effect size. When you get to number 4, you're getting down to still a moderate effect size, still something that is worth paying attention to. And I think most of you would, if you saw studies that produced that kind of effect, you would say, well, this is something worth considering. But when they looked at the studies, and there were only 7, were random assignment. They followed up on everybody, and I'll describe the criteria that are critical to being a 5 in a moment. When they really did the purest, most rigorous test, they found an effect size of 0. Now, my point here is not to say nothing works, we should quit, because I'm sure there are plenty of things out there that are promising that have not been evaluated. The majority, by the way, of correctional interventions have never been studied rigorously. But I want to make the point that this is not just something that people discuss in ivory towers because they have nothing better to do. There is a difference between the decisions you make policy-wise if you say, well, we're only going to pick the programs that have survived the litmus test of a randomized controlled trial. The number 5, you'll basically say, we've got to go back to the drawing board. We need to try some other things. I'm all for trying anything, by the way. But saying that something works because it makes perfect sense, and by the way, most of this stuff makes beautiful sense to me. Unfortunately, very few of the studies support many of our favorite programs. So that was the point I wanted to make about, and it's the most boring possible topic I could be assigning today, is to try to talk about research methods and why they're important. But I hope I can make the point that it really makes a big difference. Now, I was unsuccessful in locating a list of specific intervention studies that have been vetted thus far here in Oregon. But some of my colleagues and I have reviewed the criminal justice-related studies that are part of the National Registry of Evidence-Based Programs, if you're familiar with that. And I hope, that our findings there would serve as a cautionary tale to this group, just to be careful, just to maintain high standards and put what makes its way through the channels. Of the 31 studies that specifically targeted criminal justice populations, only 5 had a methodological rating of 3.5 or better. That was on a 4-point scale. So really kind of when you talk about the Cadillac, only 5 of the 31 met those criteria. But there was one big problem with that, and that is 68, more than 2/3 of these studies, or those 31 studies, had been authored by the proprietors of the program being studied. Now, we don't turn to tobacco executives to tell us whether or not smoking is good for us or bad for us, and nor should we turn to program developers, many of whom may be well-intentioned. We shouldn't turn to them and say, does your program work? Is this something that we should be adopting? Critical that you maintain independence in the evaluation. So the cost of low or vague research standards is particularly high when the subjects of interest are criminal offenders. Given that, I would urge you to limit the designation of evidence-based to interventions that have been shown to be effective in studies meeting the following 4 criteria. And again, I say not to just... This is just my exhortation, nothing more, but not to just say it should include these or other things like them, but to, or hopefully you'll have some of these qualities. But if, in fact, you say, oh, thank you, If, in fact, you say it has to meet these criteria, you'll change the landscape dramatically. The first of those four criteria is random assignment. I think that makes sense to everybody. There's the norm in the field is to say, well, we got a program here, and some of the guys volunteered to be in it. Some said no, and so we compare the two. We try to do some fancy statistics to compare, but we never know how everybody differs. So if you control for that at the front end by randomly assigning people, you don't have to do fancy statistics at the end because you have normalized those differences. Intent to treat analysis. This is a critical feature, and again, it is a problem with the literature in this field, and that is the many, if not most, of the studies, probably in the list that may have already been circulated here in Oregon, do something very dangerous, and that is they say, well, we started off with 100 guys in treatment and 100 guys in the comparison group, and we found that the treatment completers did much better than the guys in the comparison group. And if you should say that, you should set up a little red flag. You say, well, look, did you say the guys in the treatment group did better than the guys in the comparison group? Or did you say the guys who completed the treatment group? In many studies, the famous, one of the things that got the big prison-based treatment movements going in New York, the staying out program, had 20% graduation rates. So if you exclude, basically, they're saying if you exclude the bad guys, exclude the guys who did poorly, you wind up with some pretty good outcomes. And it's bad research, and it's particularly bothersome because this isn't just people getting something in a journal that probably shouldn't belong there, but the real-world implications are quite hazardous. So intent to treat means if you're assigned to the treatment group, if you're assigned to the control group, you stay in that group, and we count everybody a year later. We don't just count the successes or and compare them against those who got kicked out or whatever. Independently evaluated, I think I've made that point well enough, and replicated at least once. That's not very ambitious to say just one replication. You certainly wouldn't want to base any policy on a single study. I wouldn't want to rule out a program because one study said it didn't work, nor would I want to rule out a program statewide because one study said that it did work. You really want to develop a literature, at the least have one randomized controlled trial that demonstrates it and another also randomized controlled trial done elsewhere by different folks, ideally, that also found positive effects. So those four criteria, I think, are critical. And what it does is it provides a good safeguard to keep a lot of the literature, and boy, there's a lot of bad literature out there, from coming in and essentially poisoning your very noble efforts here. I say that if you did this, you would likely narrow the field of evidence-based programs from all the things out there. You'd narrow it down by about 90%. Very few interventions, studies meet all those criteria and show a positive effect. And that's, to me, is a shame. But at least you're standing on bedrock. And then you can say, okay, well, we know these few things are promising. Now let's encourage some innovation. But that as long as that innovation and those new ideas are being tested legitimately. Now, there is a problem here, and you'll run into it here, as we do in California and everyone does, and that is that randomly assigning inmates to a treatment or control group is often considered unethical because the control group is deprived of treatment. Those who raise these objections are basically saying, well, we know that because it is a program, it must be effective, and so how dare you deprive them of it? But in fact, many programs are not effective. I think I've demonstrated that. And in fact, and I can provide all the citations you need for this, there are a lot of efforts, Scared Straight being one of the most famous, that actually increase in rigorous randomized controlled trials show an increase in offender risk after the fact. So you're not necessarily, if you don't know if something works, you're not depriving somebody by not letting them get in. Random assignment is nothing evil. In fact, most of us take medications, or when we do take medications, we like to think that it went through a fairly sophisticated vetting process, something like I'm describing, not what generally prevails in the literature. So my hope for Oregon is that as lawmakers will require that the phrase evidence-based serve as more than just a marketing slogan, as it has in the National Registry and as it has in many other states. And by recognizing the need for a higher standard of evidence using the four criteria I've suggested today. You will substantially reduce the number of programs that have that will qualify for funding in the short term, but over the long term, you'll develop a network of legitimate programs that do exactly what they're funded to do, to change lives and to reduce crime. Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't we have some questions from the panel? If we could kind of restrict, we have some other people that want to speak. Are there any questions in this group right now? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I suppose a comment. I really appreciate your coming here and appreciate your work, Dr. Farabee. I've been following your work for a couple of years now. I think that actually you're onto something. In terms of criminal law and sociology, your work might be sort of one of the more useful developments perhaps since Broken Windows, and I really appreciate it. That said, frankly, the fact that the concept of swift and certain consequences towards violating parole conditions is revolutionary. It's actually depressing to me.
Representative Smith?
The answer to Representative Barton's question is yes. I want to ask, I think this sounds really interesting. And I really appreciate your rigor. My questions are around the generalizability and might be best for you, but maybe for anybody. You answered one of them, or at least posed the same question I had, which is how dependent might this be on a judge as gifted as the one we have here? And we don't know each other, but it seems relatively obvious. The second, well, it's an island state. Does that make it weird? That's actually where my dad's family was from, and I don't know if the island thing makes it weird, but I do wonder, for instance, about if they have a healthcare regime that's different. Are there drug treatment? Is the provision of other services significantly enough different from here that that's something to pay attention to? And I may have one follow-up.
Again, I think what we are going to see is replication in other jurisdictions. The outcomes are so astounding in Hawaii that other states are not going to be able to not pay attention. And we're seeing this with the rollout from the NIJ programs now where they're providing support for other sites to replicate the program. We'll have to, I don't know enough about the Hawaii health system or the Oregon health system to talk intelligently about this issue. I can say that both the comparison group, the control group, and the HOPE group, treatment was available to both groups of offenders. The only difference was that for the control group, being mandated to treatment with actual sanctions made the difference.
And I think there are other judges like me all over the country, and as long as the first one in your state, as it develops a reputation, does it the right way, it'll work fine with other people. Once it gets, as I said, or as Dr. Hawkins said, when we started, it was just me for a year and a half, so it got a good reputation that way. When it expanded to the other judges, there were some that really did not like, they were all over the park with it. A couple did not like, one guy didn't want to put anybody in jail for anything. Another, his staff just screamed about, two others, I think, the staff was so upset about having to do more work, unfortunately. And that's a leadership issue. But for the most part, the judges were ready, willing to try something new. Their staff was willing to try something new. And so for the vast majority, or the majority, it's working fine. So I think you just need a motivated judge to get it started and get a good rep, but it's possible. And I think we have a number of folks that are homeless. We have folks that are unemployed, who don't get medical care, who don't get health care right now, who are in HOPE. Who borrow a phone to call the hotline, or walk in and ask, is today my day? I mean, it does work that way.
My first trip to Hawaii, I had exactly that concern. I'd met the judge briefly in his chamber, and then I went into court with him. And I watched this man walk into court, and he is phenomenal in the courtroom, which to me was a disaster. As a researcher, I thought, okay, well, this isn't interesting at all. Am I even interested in this evaluation? Because surely what we have here is a judge effect. And very quickly, data from the Attorney General's office, though, showed me the curmudgeonly judges who did not like the program had exactly the same outcomes. So what is key here is not so much whether you have a charismatic, eloquent, interested, compassionate judge, but whether or not you have judges who enforce enforce the rules. It's the rules that drive the outcomes, not the judge personality. What was so important about this judge was that he got it started. And when rolling out to other jurisdictions, we're often hearing talk about, well, can this be handled in corrections? Can this be handled by probation officers? It's absolutely key that this be rolled out by the judges. The judges have to take the lead or it won't work.
Well, in our public servants, whether it's probation officers, police officers, these are all state employees. The vast majority rose to the occasion and have done a great job with it. You are just asking them to do something new, something faster, something quicker. A staff member scheduling a probation revocation hearing down the road once, 10 weeks down the road, takes 10 minutes of time. You may have to schedule several motions to modify, so it's going to take repeated ones. But that, the vast majority of our public, public employees were happy, ready, willing, and able to do it, and have had a good result. And if this leads to less crime coming in the front end, it helps everybody.
Thanks very much. One thing we'd want to change, Mr. Chair, is Hawaii opportunity probation is hope, but Oregon opportunity probation would be oops. So I think we'd want to change our acronym. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Senator Krasinski, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Hawken, I was wondering if you'd be willing to share us your complete PowerPoint presentation so we'd have that as literature.
Absolutely, I'll send it to you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Farabee, Oregon has really bought into your evidence-based program, and your data is sort of concerning to me. We've had you're saying only 5 of the 31 studies seem to be, I'm assuming you're saying, working. Do we need to be looking at what we're doing here? And isn't there a revisionist position out there now that's questioning some of evidence-based studies? And, do we need to be looking at what we're doing? We're getting ready to, we're coming into some very difficult financial situations. And again, you've pointed out that a lot of these studies we're buying from the people who designed them. So are we going down a slippery slope here? And
I wish I could have found a list of the interventions and the studies that have been signed off on. I wish I could have found that before I came up here. I couldn't. I used as a proxy the National Registry information, so I don't know to what extent that would be better or worse than what you're doing. But I can say that it is a misconception to say, well, we don't have a bunch of great studies, but we do have some mediocre ones here, so let's go with what they say. Because you might as well, my opinion is, if you can't do a real study, using the criteria I just said, don't bother, because you can prove anything. You could give me a fake program, and I could crunch the numbers in a way to show you that it's wildly effective. If I'm not hobbled by those darn criteria, where you've got to randomly assign folks and be independent and follow up on everybody and all those things. So I would just, yes, it can be a very costly mistake. And as you know, once you say, well, these are good, then they will lumber on for years before something happens where that becomes overturned. So I think it's critical to have high standards at the front end and define those by the criteria that I suggested. And the downside of that is that that will be a very small number of studies, but at least they're real.
Real quick one for Dr. Hawken. Dr. Hawken, in your comments you said that we should, and again, looking at the financial situation, how we're going to spend our money, you said we should really go after those who need it. Isn't there some argument that says, we should get rid of the easier ones first because it's less cost?
Well, that was exactly my point. I, at the end, I said there was in limitations of my study. I'm quite concerned about the obvious policy implications of my own research, which suggest the effect sizes are larger in the specialized unit than in the general probation unit. My concern is that everybody is going to target the big fish, because that's the obvious recommendation from my study. I think a lifetime crime cycle analysis, which we haven't had a lifetime to study them yet, will very clearly show that there's a big return for your bang for your buck by focusing on those newbie offenders who are quickly turned around. The behavior change will come in quickly for them. And my other data from California shows those newbies become big bees if we don't act now. So I would really be cautious of taking a recommendation away that says focus on the big users. But it's kind of, when there are resource constraints, they're the obvious place to start because they're also the highest risk. And for public safety reasons, there might be an emphasis on the big fish to begin with.
Thank you.
Right, and if I could follow up on that, it sounds crazy. We should put them all. This, truly, I would love to get the 20-year-old who comes into court on their first felony, who's using drugs every couple of weeks, and stopping that in its tracks. And if they can go from age 20 to age 25, not picking up an ice pipe or putting it down at the start, then by 25 they may have, you know, a wife or husband, girlfriend, job, all of that, and never get started up again. But I think you've got to focus on the highest risk folks because they're the ones committing most of the crime. But the more you can go into it, you're helping more and more people. And it is easier. It's going to take less judge time, less PO time, because those folks will stay on board with it.
So. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the point that you're saying about the need for adequate research is very well taken. I think that if we could take just 1% of the Department of Corrections budget and just apply it to researching what works and what doesn't, we would do a lot to reduce crime. But my question is to Dr. Hawkins, related to that, is how much did the study cost from beginning to end, or will it when
our research done? Study? Mm-hmm. We had two. You know, part of doing research in Hawaii and even from California was expensive, just because of the travel costs. So I think if it was a mainland set of researchers studying a mainland project, it would have been less expensive. So quite a bit of us, our work went into travel budget. We had funding from the National Institutes of Justice to study the first probation office, and that was I'm sure I'm allowed to mention these dollar figures. It was $130,000 from NIJ for the evaluation. And we were then given, for the randomized control trial, we had funding from the Smith Richardson Foundation. And we submitted a proposal to do the study at about the same dollar cost, about $130,000. And the Smith Richardson Foundation is quite unusual. It went to their board, and they really saw a lot of merit in the study, that if we could get this right, if we could find a program like this and it actually works as well as they had said it worked in Hawaii, and we didn't know if it did work as well, that the social benefit would be enormous. So they came back to us and they doubled our budget. They said, we want to make sure you actually implement a randomized control trial, which is very hard to do well if you do it sloppily. So they insisted that we hire locals. We had added to staff capacity on the ground in Hawaii. I think we could have, you know, when you have more money, you spend more money. My strong feeling is that if we had started with that initial budget and were forced to live within that initial budgetary amount, we probably could have pulled it off. So my expectation is that for any specific probation office, a study like this could be conducted in about the $200,000 range.
And follow up. So does that include any in-kind costs? Were any of your salaries in part funded by the university?
It helps. I'm personally a tenure-track professor, so I'm hard salary, which means that my salary doesn't change if I do research or not. Some researchers are soft money researchers, so they get paid by the research grants. I was a relative cheapie, and other researchers are not. But I still had quite a bit of my budget was allocated to research staff. Being based at a university certainly helps. I never had to pay for office overhead. Computers and software were just there. I also had an extraordinary fleet of talented students, which is helpful. So being in academia can keep costs down in ways that other research units might not have the opportunity.
Can I ask one final question? So this is for Dr. Huggins. What do you think, if anything, we might be able to infer about longer prison sentences, not jail sentences, in mandatory sentences based on the research that you've done?
Certainly for nonviolent drug offenses, I think if anything, this research shows that longer penalties are silly. We just don't need them. And if anything, it takes away your opportunity to bring about behavior change. If I'm incarcerating a drug user with a relatively with a nonviolent drug charge, I'm sanctioning him once. So I'm slapping his hand only once, and then he's gone away for a long time. If I can repeatedly sanction him, you know, it's like training a puppy. Every time he pees, you slap him on the bottom and send him outside. That puppy changes their behavior very quickly. If I only hit the puppy once really hard and then I send him outside permanently, I'm never going to be able to bring him indoors. The same thing with nonviolent drug offenders. If we put them away for a long time, we're losing the opportunity to bring about behavior change. This is different for violent offenders. We're talking about nonviolent offenders at this stage. In this, we have, however, in the Hawaii study, I only discussed the drug offender outcomes today. They're seeing essentially equivalent results for sex offenders and domestic violence offenders. I'm still yet to get someone to be interested in putting the money into that evaluation, which is an important one to be done, because the kinds of changes we're seeing in outcomes for sex offenders and DV offenders is extraordinary.
And nobody is excluded from hope. And I think our prosecutor has raised the concern that he hopes judges don't like hope or see it too much, so that at the sentencing date, if somebody's violent and dangerous, my philosophy is send them to prison. That's where they belong. If you're going to put them in probation, then decide should it be hope or not. I think our prosecutor's concerned judges may not send them to prison initially, thinking that hope will be there to deal with them. So, and I've encouraged my fellow judges, you know, let's, the ones that need to go to prison, send them to prison. Then if they're going to be put on probation, decide whether you're going to put them in hope or not. You know, that's a different thing. I don't think you can trust any probation project if somebody is violent or dangerous. That said, once somebody is on probation, we are trying to get the toughest folks that are in there into the program.
The other thing is that there is, drug addiction does spill over into other crime categories. So we do have people in, you know, certainly you'd have some sellers who are incarcerated who may have been drug involved and then selling as a function of their drug involvement. You might have individuals incarcerated on property crimes who are drug involved and committing those offenses to pursue their drug habits. If we could identify those offenders, they may well be a very good effect for kind of lower level property criminals to be put into a program like HOPE too, with those same kinds of drug requirements. So I expect that it would extend well beyond just drug offenders also.
Council? Get your drink in here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I just have a couple of quick questions, I think for Judge Alm primarily. I was wondering, typically are offenders assigned to HOPE based solely on noncompliance in their current probation, or it sounds like from some comments you made, are there judges who make the decision to send an offender into the HOPE program at the beginning of their sentence?
It's all of the above. When we first started, we identified that specialized unit had kind of the defendants had self-selected that they were the worst. They were having the most profound drug problems. And that's how they got into that group, half of it. The other half were sex offenders. So we started with that group. And then the way the system works is people in regular probation, there's an internal transfer process to the high-risk group. Since then, everybody in the high-risk group, they're now 700 folks, 900 folks that they supervise, they're all in HOPE. Judges at sentencing also have the discretion to put anybody they want into HOPE probation. And often if somebody's on regular probation and there's a motion to revoke probation, the probation officer still would recommend most 99 times out of 100, send them to prison. But if you want to put them on probation, put them in HOPE. And I think last week for the first time I saw prosecutors and defense counsel had worked out a plea agreement and it said put him in HOPE probation. Mm-hmm. So it's becoming institutionalized that way, but it allows for all of the above.
Follow up, please.
Okay, just a couple more if you don't mind.
Sure.
Is it just the judge that makes the decision, or is it collaborative? Do you have the POs sometimes coming to you, or do the DAs ever have a role in asking, aside from that one plea kind of arrangement?
Some of the time at sentencing, the two attorneys will say, we recommend you put this person in HOPE, or the prosecutors will recommend it, or the public defender will recommend it. It's often done at the probation officer's behest after the person has been in for a while and is starting to have problems. So it's any possible way that somebody is identifying it. We have six felony judges doing it. If it's one of the judges who's not currently in it and they think somebody might be appropriate, they recommend it to probation, and probation will, you know, recommend it to me or one of the other judges, and then we can put it in.
Is it only drug crimes at this time?
No, it's domestic violence, it's sex offenders. Every person who's on probation for a sex offense in Hawaii, a felony, is now in HOPE. So they are that is the one group that we are automatically putting them in HOPE. Not that they, and I think you folks realize they don't necessarily offend as often perhaps as some other groups, but the judiciary and the public and everybody just feels a heightened need to monitor them more closely. So they're all in HOPE. And we're trying to fine-tune it, so if a person is in a drug treatment program but they're starting to backslide, they may do internal contracts and other things, but also they may call the probation officer and say, file a motion to modify. They'd set it Friday in my courtroom. I give the guy a weekend in jail. So he understands the treatment providers are talking to the probation officers. It's not these silos out there. We want this seamless web of conversation going on so the offenders realize the whole treatment community, probation officer, everybody's talking to each other and they're talking to the judge.
And I think I just have one more.
Okay, please.
Are these people then, when you're talking about all these different crimes, are these folks that typically would be sentenced to probation, or are they people that are looking at prison sentences and would likely have gone to prison but for the creation of something like HOPE, a downward departure?
Should be people that were going to be on probation anyway. I guess the one exception to that is I don't know if in reality it is an exception. When the person is getting revoked for probation, the probation officer is recommending the prison, but often the judges would put them back on probation for another 5 years. So I've had cases transferred to me from other judges where they've been on probation for 14 years. So to me, this program really is like one of those MasterCard commercials where you could make a great one, a $5 rapid drug, a rapid drug screen, $5. Outpatient program, $1.50 a day. The benefits of having a HOPE probation with integrity to the system is priceless.
Okay, thank you very much, panel. We really appreciate it.
Chair.
I'm sorry.
Chair.
I have one other question. Okay, it's for Dr. Hawken when she gets back. Okay. And Doctor, you may have covered this in your presentation regarding your analysis and where you're at with the status of the HOPE program. Could you tell us as to what your plan is, longevity, as to how much more testing and review are you going to do before you reach a point of saying long term that it's a winner?
We are completing our first evaluation plan. We have a report that's coming out in May, which will include a full cost study, which may be of interest to all of you. This is incarceration saving. Many people, when we discussed the program, assumed that this would be jail sanction enhancing, but it turns out if you give really small terms rather than long terms for a small group of people, it saves jail costs. It'll be rolling out next May, or this May. We plan to follow up. We're waiting for additional money. We're out of funds, so we'll be applying for additional research funding to do longer term follow up, including hair samples. We're also really interested in starting to look at some brain imaging. Try to see if there's some basic science behind this too. Have we fundamentally changed how people respond to drug cues through this HOPE model to really understand the mechanisms underlying the big differences that we've observed? So we plan to study these guys for a really, really long time. Hopefully, as long as the Hawaiians will have patience with us, we'll be there.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to call two more panels up, and we're coming towards the end of the day. But I'd like to have Judge Maurer, Judge Marcus, and Judge Block in the first group, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. I am Jean Maurer, and I'm the presiding judge in Multnomah County, and it's an honor to be here. I know that time is limited, but I wanted to tell you just a little bit about my background to put some context here. I've been a judge for 13 years, and for the last 15 months, I've been the presiding judge in Multnomah County. And for 22 years before I became a judge, I was a lawyer in practice, about half of my career in the district attorney's office. And just before I became a judge, I was in the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I'm not really sure where I would fall on that charismatic scale that's been described here by others, or on the other scale that was described about the judges in Hawaii. But I do want to say on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department that we are always interested, I would say, in any kind of model treatment courts. This Hope Court has been very interesting, and I have enjoyed listening to Judge Alm. I would hope that any treatment court model that might be considered would be one that would be tailored to Oregon, to take into account the differences that have been described somewhat by Judge Alm and by Dr. Hawken. For example, our agencies here in Oregon are funded differently, of course. We have our probation services funded by counties as opposed to the state. And we don't, for example, have the ability to keep people on probation for 14 years. But I think it's very interesting what Judge Alm has done there. And I think it's fair to say that with sufficient and adequate funding in Oregon for the courts, we would be most open to any kind of model treatment courts. We have many in Oregon. We have several in Multnomah County. We were second, I believe, in the nation for our drug treatment court. I have here Judge Block, who is our judge, who has for many years supervised our DUI intensive supervision in Multnomah County. And I know he has a lot to tell you as well and can answer any questions that you have, and I'd be happy to do so, too. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you for coming. Judge Marcus?
Sure.
Judge Block.
Judge Block.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and with all due respect and deference to my presiding judge, I really don't have a lot to tell you, but I am here available to answer questions and hopefully have some knowledge to bring to bear in response to questions you might have. Just again, quickly, my background. I've been on the bench since January 1st of 2003, and I was quickly drafted into the role of supervising judge for the DUII Intensive Supervision Program, which is our DUII treatment court in Multnomah County. It's one of the oldest DUII courts in the nation. It's the largest DUII court in the nation by about a factor of two. I think the second largest is in Phoenix, Arizona, and they've got about half the number of people we have. And our recidivism rates that have been documented through independent studies are in my judgment, fairly impressive. We take what many have referred to, rightly or wrongly, as the worst of the worst. We serve a population of folks who have multiple DUII convictions. Our average is about three. We have people in our program who have double digits. I think our current record holder is 13 DUIIs lifetime. We have some people who are first-time offenders who just recognize they have significant substance abuse problems and need help. We take this population. They've been offending and getting new DUIIs on average every year to 18 months, and our 3- and 5-year post-graduation studies show that we've got about a 12% recidivism rate, so about 88 of 100 people who complete our program of that sort are not going on and reoffending post-graduation. I listened very carefully to all the comments from my colleague from Hawaii, who seems, I agree, like a model jurist, and I'm looking forward to an invitation to go and witness his great work firsthand. And I also listened very carefully to the other comments that were offered in critique of his program. The good news is, for me, is that I agree with virtually everything that's been said. The attitude, the approach that needs to be brought to bear to this population in terms of supervision with accountability, where we're promoting treatment of the right sort, basing our actions on reality, not what the offenders or we want to have happen or wish would have happened, but rather we need to focus on what is actually going on in the lives of the offenders and proceed on that basis. I agree with much that's been said. The further bit of good news is that we have many programs, many of our treatment courts in this state, and I'm not intimately familiar with every one of our programs, so I won't say everyone, but I can certainly say the program that we run in Multnomah County, as well as many others with which I am familiar, have many, many of the same features as has been described as being part of the HOPE program in Hawaii. We do announce expectations clearly at the outset. We promote appropriate treatment, and it's long-term treatment that's appropriate for the needs of the individual. We monitor whether people go to treatment. Just a quick story, when I first took over the program, which was up and running, I looked for ways to improve it based upon what I perceived to be lackings and failings in the program. One of the things we saw was that we were sending people off to treatment and not doing a lot of follow-up, and as a consequence, there are a lot of folks who were missing, canceling, or rescheduling treatment. So I thought, well, what could we do about that? Well, here's an idea. I'll just write into the probation conditions the following condition. You may not miss, cancel, or reschedule treatment for any reason without prior permission of the court. And I thought, well, that's a good start at least. Let's see how far that gets us. The reality is that what we clearly announced that expectation and then followed that up with enforcement in the point that anyone who missed, canceled, or rescheduled treatment, their treatment provider contacted the court immediately that very same day. And then we had the probationer in court the very next day explaining, and I used to say you'll be explaining to me, and I will be a very skeptical audience, why you are refusing to accept the treatment that is necessary for you to get well from the disease of alcoholism and for the community safety to be preserved. Through that step alone, we saw attendance at treatment go way, way up to the point where virtually no one is missing treatment anymore. The numbers are minuscule, and of course, when they do, they're brought in. Swift responses are essential. You can't wait for the offender to do three good things by the time you get around to dealing with them regarding that bad thing that they did. From a behavior modification standpoint, it's a disaster. You need to bring them in quickly. Just to sum up or to conclude, just a couple of caveats. We need to maintain flexibility, and I clarified this point with Judge Ohm before, and I think we're on the same page here. Whatever model we adopt, it needs to hold the defendant accountable, and if they do something wrong, we need to have the capacity to detect noncompliance and then sanction that. The precise sanction needs to be left to the discretion of the judge. Sometimes jail is entirely appropriate. In my DUII court, with the obvious connection, direct connection and implication for public safety that comes from drunk driving, we use jail often as a sanction. But sometimes that's not the right sanction. If you get an individual who's been in prison for years, who's been in jail very recently, sometimes it's better to have them do work crew, or sometimes it's better to have them do community service. They can do jail standing on their head, but you give them work crew and make them go pick up garbage or go do community service, then you can really see them howl. And so if what you're trying to do is discourage that bad behavior by imposing something that they consider to be a punishment,
you have to have the flexibility based upon the experience you gain from working with that individual. What does this person consider to be a punishment? Sometimes it's jail, often it may be, sometimes it's not. The final comment I would offer is I think that there's many opportunities to improve the work that we're doing with probationers, and the Hope Court model, which is very similar to many of the treatment courts we have in Oregon, is a great model that will yield enormous benefits to the state for public safety as well as for the recovery of the individual, and that's really the win-win. When we can promote public safety by recovery, helping the individual to recover from their drug and alcohol problems, that's the best case scenario. That's the most durable, sustainable solution for public safety. I would simply urge the committee to take into consideration when it looks at this bill or any other similar approaches, take into consideration that we do have treatment courts already existing in this state, and maybe there are additional populations beyond the population that's in our drug courts for possession of a controlled substance, beyond the population that's in Dewey courts for committing DUII. Maybe there are other populations that can and should be served by this model. I'd be the first to say probably yes, but let's not do anything that undoes the good work that's been accomplished in the treatment court area in this state, where the judiciary and the legislative branch and the executive branch have worked very successfully in partnership to get those courts in place.
Okay, thank you
very much.
And Judge Marcus, before you start, I just want to say a number of the committee members have other obligations, and we're scheduled to 3:00. Those who have to leave, go ahead and leave. Those who would like to stay, I'd appreciate if you'd stay. And we have 4 more people signed up to speak. So.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for coming all the way down to speak, too. I hate to cut you short.
As you know, it's hard to keep me away. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is my 20th year as a trial court judge. I've attached some description of my involvement in prior legislation on the third page of my written testimony. The last page is from the Hawaii court website about the Hope Court. Nevada calls this court, by the way, the Habitual Offender Prevention and Education Court. The first substantive criterion is number 3 on the list. The most difficult high-risk probationers should be targeted for Hope, including violent, domestic violence, and sex offenders. One thing that the Maryland study, which is often cited as the most comprehensive of all studies of what works and what doesn't work, and which used this notion of a gold standard and lesser standards of rigor in measuring outcomes, what it said was the most important outcome of all is, quote, not whether something works, but what works on whom. We always get into these debates about what works without remembering that different things work on different people. The element that the Hawaii court uses as an important criterion is high-risk offenders. Now, Hope's high-risk offenders are not necessarily the same as ours would be. And, for example, ballot measure 57, in my view, includes a lot of people who are not high-risk offenders within the meaning of the Hope category. Paul Blatty, who's sitting behind me back there in the hearing room someplace, is working on identifying which members of that cohort are likely to be high risk and not. But it is critical for us to understand that doing some things on some people does a lot of good, and doing the same things on other people does a lot of harm. You cannot get there from here without understanding that some things work on other people than the ones who are in front of you. And just because you like the model and you're ideologically comfortable with its means doesn't mean it's most likely to work on the offenders who's in front of you. So it's very critical. What works on whom? The second point has to do with measuring outcomes. I am absolutely enthusiastic about the notion that we need to measure outcomes. And my gripe with most measures is, in addition to some that you've already heard, is we got to remember what it is we're measuring. You can use the best possible gold standard and measure whether we get more or less UAs. But the real thing we need to measure is recidivism.
Because the reason we're putting all of this energy into this stuff is to prevent victimization, prevent crime. And unless you measure outcomes in terms of recidivism, it doesn't matter how good your protocol is. If you measure how many missed appointments there are, that might translate into reduced crime, but you don't know that until you subject that to a randomized measure, and nobody suggested that. You've got to measure outcomes in terms of public safety impact. One more point, and this is really, really critical. Remember where the mainstream is. There is nothing about the mainstream of sentencing that has been measured by anything, by any protocol. And yet we defend any motion from it by insisting on the highest protocol available. It is essentially impossible to do what we all agree is the best possible study, which is a randomized study of what you do with offenders. I just completed a civil trial in which the issue of gold standard versus less was involved in causation related to pain pumps versus chondrolysis, which is the loss of the shoulder joint. I'm on a national committee with the National Institute of Corrections, which is studying evidence-based practices. It has a report, not yet for distribution, which recognizes six levels of study from gold to dirt. Yes, it's critical that you understand the quality of the research before you rely on it. But to say that we can't move off what's obviously not working without a gold standard is to say we're not moving until I approve where you move. Every decision you make as legislators, and every decision I make as a judge, and every decision a jury makes in my courtroom, even in the most serious criminal cases with the highest standard of proof, cannot rely on random assignment. It just isn't there. We have to use our best judgment, the best evidence, and our best ability to produce the best practical protocol to change where we are, because where we are is our sentencing generally produces 60 to 75% recidivism. I'm absolutely certain that our treatment courts and anything like the Hope Court, properly applied to the right people, will do far better than prison in reducing crimes, preventing recidivism, preventing victimization for most offenders, and I'm also absolutely convinced we need to lock some up as long as we can. But we need to move away from the notion that we have to have perfection before we can move from mediocrity, because mediocrity is what we have. What we have is avoidable victimizations because we're not rigorous in demanding that everything we do in sentencing have some demonstrable validity to it in terms of crime reduction. Treatment courts are the best thing we've got going. Please don't sabotage them to put another treatment court in place and start over.
Thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and skip. One question.
One quick. Is it Judge Brackton?
Block.
Regarding behavior modification, we know that it's important to have immediate sanctions, and you have given us different alternatives that you want to have for discretion depending on who's before you. Sure. Regarding those immediate sanctions in Multnomah County, do you have access to beds in the jail? And if so, do they actually carry out the sentence that you impose? Do you have a special unit that they are going to stay there? As well as if you're using community service or some type of other type of sanction to get them in immediately to do whatever you want, as compared to prolonging the time out before the sanctions actually applied.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brzezinski, generally speaking, we have a very close and good working relationship with all the partners, including the DA's office, the defense bar, and our sheriff's department who runs our jails. Everybody's very supportive of our program because they understand that it works. Even in the worst of times, when there were releases being made from our jails, which is my understanding not happening certainly to the extent it once was, our folks, when we imposed a jail sanction, did go to jail and did stay in jail. We of course have a responsibility as partners in the overall criminal justice system in our county. We judges need to understand that we need to find that sweet spot in terms of imposing the jail that's going to get the job done, no more than, no less than, and we try and take that into account. When it comes to the distance
that travels between the imposition of the sanction, let's say it's community service. We do the best we can. We don't have a mechanism that really pushes us to the front of the line where they're signing up for community service. One of the things, and this is just an approach that we've taken, that we've sort of cobbled together, and we believe it's certainly better than what otherwise would be the case. We are most interested in getting people before the judge, standing by their probation officer as quickly as possible. So if we find out that someone's given a dirty UA or somebody has done something else that violates the conditions of their probation, what we're really focused on is get them before the judge, because we believe there is great therapeutic value, as I think Judge Holmes said. We need to let them know, and also the researcher, we need to have credibility in our program. They have to believe that if they violate, they will be detected and detected swiftly. And so half the game is won if they're in front of the judge within, let's say, 24 hours, and the judge is saying, we know this is what you did, and this is what we are going to require of you as a result. So that's really the approach that we take.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Thank you,
all right,
panel.
Thank you.
And now I'll call four people up next. There's four seats up here. Judge Larson, Judge Graves, Shannon Carey, and Greg Hazarabedian. Yeah, thank you.
Greg?
There's a Greg, on the Greg there's one on the side there.
Thank you.
And you start, please, Judge, in the order here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Darrell Larson, and I'm a retired circuit judge from Wayne County. I also am, because I've regained my private life after being retired, I'm now the chair of the Criminal Justice Commission in the state of Oregon. And I appear here today with dramatically modified comments based on what we've already heard. I want to cut to the chase. I appreciate Judge Alm being here today. Thanks, Steve Dole, I think, for arranging that. He's preaching to the choir with the people that are up here. We don't need to go over that. I think all of us who have been drug court judges in the state of Oregon, we know we've been in an Easter basket for a long time, and I'm very glad that Dr. Hawkins has realized that there's an Easter egg in Hawaii. There is an Easter egg in Hawaii, and I know it works. It has to be with fidelity done to the models that have been designed and researched over and over and over again. The beauty of what has happened in Oregon is the expansion of what I would like to refer to as problem-solving courts. I think sometimes people get hung up on labels, hope or, you know, drop or stop or whatever the terminology is. That's a red herring. What we need to do is look at problem-solving courts and the model that's been shown to really work, and it's working for Judge Alm, and it's been working for a lot of us here in the state of Oregon. It can wrap around a problem. It can be flexible and creative enough to be designed for that particular community and that particular population, consistent with the politics of the community. And the politics of the community in Oregon and most places is going to resolve down to what the DA wants to have happen, what the DA can live with politically, and to the extent that the state is directing what that should be, then that's the way it's going to be. With respect to the reason I'm here today is that the state of Oregon is going to be the happy recipient of about $13 million to the Criminal Justice Commission from federal stimulus money. And one of the things that we would like to do, and we apologize for the timing of this, it was really driven by the application process for the federal government to figure out